We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning. He is not feeling well.
Yeah, he's at home taking care of himself.
Yeah, bringing up liquids that aren't supposed to come back up. All right, let's dive in, starting with local and Block 59.
Yeah. As part of the South Lake Union rezone that the city council is considering, Mayor Mike McGinn came forward with a proposal that he had been discussing with Vulcan Inc. That's Paul Allen's real estate development company, which owns several pieces of property in South Lake Union. Some folks would say they're the major landholder in South Lake Union. And they own some parcels along the waterfront they wanted to build buildings on, and they wanted to build 24-story buildings. Well, the current zoning in South Lake Union sets a limit on how high you can build along the waterfront of 65 feet, which is about 6 to 7 stories, depending on how big, you know, you make these buildings. And Vulcan said, oh, no, that's not profitable. We want to develop our parcels, and we want to go to 24 stories. And to do that, the current zoning rules say that, well, you can go up to 16 stories if you pay a bonus to the city for that, and usually that money is used for things like providing low income housing, that sort of thing. And then the proposed rules say, well, you could go higher than 16 stories if you provide, let's see, what's the wording, extraordinary additional public benefits. And those are not defined. They're vague, and they're open to interpretation, and they're open to negotiation. Most importantly, they're open to negotiation between the developer and the city council and the mayor. And that's where this Vulcan deal comes in. Mayor Mike McGinn had been talking to Vulcan, and then he turned around and presented to the city council, well, here, let's strike a deal with Vulcan and let them go to 24 stories. And in exchange, we'll get this little parcel of land called Block 59. And it borders on some land that the city already owns. And if we have those two parcels together, we can do anything we want with them. We can develop them into low-income housing. We can build administrative building there or whatever. And the city council's been looking at that deal, and folks have been commenting on it. And the city council decided to set that deal aside. They said, basically, no, we're not interested in cutting that kind of a deal, exchanging a piece of property. We're not sure what the value is and whether or not we will even have the money to develop it and to manage a low-income housing project in return for letting Vulcan build these really tall, extremely tall buildings on the South Lake Union waterfront. So I thought that was kind of interesting that the city council, instead of jumping in there and doing like they did with the Pacific Place parking garage, jumping in there and saying, oh, yeah, what a great deal. This will redevelop the neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. Let's do this. You know, let's take on this new asset that we don't know how to manage. So what, you know, if it costs the taxpayers a lot of money to develop it and build there, and we may not get our investment back, you know. Instead of doing that, they said, well, no. We're not willing to do that. And I thought that was actually a pretty good decision. On the other hand, they didn't say definitely that they were going to reject the Vulcan proposal to go to 24 feet. They left it open.
Stories.
Or 24 stories, sorry. Yeah, 24 feet. 24 stories, yeah. They left it open for Vulcan to come back with another proposal and another option for what those extraordinary additional public benefits could be.
Yeah.
So. And, you know, and they kind of, first they separated this project from the South Lake Union rezone, because they are still considering the rezoning for South Lake Union to raise the building heights there, which I thought was a smart move, because it really is separate from that. You know, when you're striking one deal with one company or one developer, or one landlord, you want that to be separate from your view of the total rezone of a whole area of your city. I think that's very important. But on the other hand, Vulcan, again, is the major landowner in South Lake Union. And they've managed to strike some pretty good deals with past mayors and past city councils. For example, you can see that they've got their own trolley now into South Lake Union, which ends there, doesn't go anywhere in particular except downtown. And I find it interesting because whenever I need to walk down to South Lake, whenever I need to go to South Lake Union from downtown, I just walk, and it's faster than waiting for and taking the trolley. They also have been able to negotiate hundreds of millions of dollars for the Mercer Beautification Project, which really didn't help traffic at all. As I know, working for a company in Lower Queen Anne, that it didn't help any of our employees get to work or get home faster. In fact, it's slowed times. But it basically was a gift to landowners in South Lake Union to make the whole Mercer corridor much prettier, essentially, is what it did. So, you know, and then of course, Vulcan lobbied for and got the public money to fix up the South Lake Park or Lake Union Park to make it look nice along the waterfront there. Now they want to build some big office corporate towers there to take advantage of that.
Well, and they got the contract for Yesler.
Yeah, they did. For Terrace? The redevelopment of Yesler Terrace. That's true.
Which is a major redevelopment.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, Vulcan trades on the fact that they have a lot of influence and they own a lot of property right adjacent to downtown, and they have a good relationship, and they've had an ongoing for decades now, relationship with various mayors and various members of the city council. So I found it was kind of interesting that they finally got a no, or not a definite no, but not yet and not quite the deal we want.
Not right now. All right, let's move on. Our new governor coming out with a jobs package.
Yeah, our new supposedly liberal Democratic governor, Jay Inslee, came out with his proposal for a jobs package. And this is kind of interesting because this is a year when it seems really apparent that there's going to be gridlock in Olympia. It's a year when the state Senate and the state House have to come together and pass a budget deal. And the problem is we have Democratic control in the state House, and we've got Republican control in the state Senate, with the two turncoat Democrats going over to the Republican side and caucusing with the Republicans and basically showing that, yes, we're not really Democrats. Yes, we are Republicans. Now, this is after Rodney Tom, one of those turncoat Democrats, who switched sides in order to gain the majority speakership of the Senate. He came out and he said, well, you know, Democrats shouldn't worry because we're not going to consider any of these little sideline bills. All that the Senate is going to do this year in Olympia is look at the budget. That's what he said, basically. And all that's happened since the start of the legislature is these little sideline bills where the Republicans are trying to undo Democratic initiatives that have been passed in the past that they really can't justify any particular reason why you should undo them. And one of those things happened this week, among some other terrible things that were going on in the state Senate. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But in a year where it appears that there's going to be gridlock and the most important thing that has to happen in Olympia is pass a budget, and that may not be much in the works, I find it kind of interesting that Inslee isn't pushing for various budget proposals necessarily. He comes out with a jobs bill, and what is contained in this jobs bill is also interesting because it doesn't relate to what's going to happen or what needs to happen budgetarily in order for the state to balance its budget. We need to either look at deep cuts after years and years of cuts to the state budget, or they need to find some way to raise revenue. And the governor has never, you know, our new governor has never said what his proposal is to raise revenue. He's never come out and said, well, these are the cuts that I've specified that will take care of the budget, or these are the initiatives I'd like the Democrats to push in the state legislature to raise revenue. Instead, his jobs package contains the cost of it is about $120 million, and it includes things like tax exemptions for new businesses. And one particular thing that stood out for me was a direct gift to rich folks, no excise taxes or registration fees on private jet repairs. Now, he called that a part of his business bill, his creating jobs bill, because he says, you know, giving tax breaks for jet repairs. That means,
which I think we can all relate to.
Yeah. That means that people from all over the country will bring their private jets here to be fixed. And I just want to say, yeah, but do you think rich people need tax breaks? Come on. You know, this is a year when we need the tax revenue, you know? And since when do rich folks need a tax break? The kind of folks who can afford to own a private jet. Rich folks and large corporations.
How many jets are we talking about here?
Well, there are quite a few of them. And like I said, most of them are owned by large companies that they make available to their top corporate officers. So I looked at that and I just kind of laughed and thought, you know, do we have another turncoat Democrat here in our own state governor? But I thought that was kind of interesting to include tax exemptions for new businesses in a year when the other Democrats in the legislature are talking about things like closing tax loopholes and getting rid of tax exemptions. It just really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But when it comes to creating jobs, you know, it seems to me like the ingenuity of our Democratic politicians fails them, and they always default to the Republican mantra of tax breaks for corporations, tax breaks for the rich, and that's somehow going to create jobs. We're going to talk a little later about how that isn't really true.
All right.
And then, of course, as I said, the Senate Republicans this week came out with a particularly bad bill, a little sideline bill again, to repeal Seattle's new sick leave law. And when I saw this SB 5728, I just kind of scratched my head and I asked myself, what the heck is wrong with paid sick leave? You know, what is wrong with paid sick leave that the Republicans would waste their time in the Senate coming up with a bill that would basically give the state legislature the sole ability to impose paid sick leave requirements for the state, and that cities and local jurisdictions would then not be allowed to do that. So it would effectively repeal Seattle's sick leave law. And then I looked at it a little bit closer, and I realized that the reason why the Senate Republicans proposed this bill is because they were basically responding to their major donors, their major constituents, which includes big businesses and large corporations who have made donations to a lot of state legislators' campaign funds. Big businesses like, for example, McDonald's Corporation, which is not based anywhere near Washington State, but has plenty of outlets here in the city of Seattle. And they're pretty irked that they have to spend a little more money now to provide some paid sick time for their employees. So I found that kind of interesting in a year when Rodney Thom, the turncoat Democrat who's leading the Senate, said, we're not going to focus at all on any of these little sideline bills. We're just going to talk about the budget. He supports this bill. He's behind the Republicans all the way when they're going after these little sideline bills that will directly affect workers. And I should point out, no Seattle senators have said that they would sponsor or sign on to that bill. I found that particularly interesting.
All right, moving on to national and the State of the Union address.
Yeah, that's the main national news this week, is Obama's State of the Union address and the Republicans' rebuttal. I thought it was kind of interesting, you know, it's a State of the Union address, but in this case, it really was a state of disunion, because that's literally what we have in Congress. We have a Congress that for a couple years now, or for longer, depending on how you really look at it, has not been able to get together and agree on much of anything. In fact, we've had John Boehner, the leader of the House Republicans, basically come out and say, well, you know, the sequester is probably going to happen because we won't be able to get a budget bill passed. That's sort of like you or I going to work and telling our bosses, well, I'm just going to sit here today and I'm not going to do any work. And I'm not going to do any work tomorrow, and I won't be doing any work for probably the next 2 months. That's essentially what he's saying, that the House simply can't get its job done and pass a budget bill. And you should know the budget bill has been delayed for months now. It should have been passed late last year. So the State of the Union address, the president really is his chance to propose what he thinks Congress should be doing in the next year. And really, it's Congress's role to take what the president proposes and decide whether or not any of that's going to actually happen. So in a year when we can pretty much count on congressional gridlock, I had to ask myself all during his speech, really, you know, where's the money for this stuff going to come from? That's what I was asking myself throughout his whole speech. And what I found is that he did this interesting trick where he would propose something that sounds really, really good, you know, that would be very popular among Americans, you know, if it could actually get done. But we know the reality is that it won't get done. And then he would turn around right afterwards and say, well, here's also this thing that I want to do that we know will get done. And it really is taking a page from the Republican playbook. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what some of those things were. So he said, well, we need to pass a budget that's going to avoid the sequester. Well, we know that's not going to happen when we've had the Speaker of the House say, well, it's not going to get done. So we know that's not going to happen. And then he turned around and he said, well, we need tax reform, and we know that's not going to happen. But then he turned around and he said, entitlement reform. Well, we know that's going to happen. And what entitlement reform means is Medicare cuts. And that's something that the Republicans have been talking about for a long time, and something that when you have the Democratic president, really the leader of his party, saying, yes, we need to do entitlement reform. Well, when you have that happen, when you have, you know, the Republicans saying it and the leader of the Democratic Party saying it, that means it's going to get done and it's not going to be pretty. And then he also presented a jobs program. It's very interesting. He talked about businesses partnering with the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy to, well, I don't know what, provide military contracting jobs. You know that's going to get done.
Yeah, that's a winner.
Yeah, that's a winner. And not necessarily a good thing either.
No. And then sarcastic.
Yes, and then to address global warming, he said, well, what we need to do is pass a cap and trade program. He basically was talking about a cap and trade program, which we know is not going to happen because the Republicans will not countenance a cap and trade program, which, by the way, is probably not the best thing to happen for global warming. I think a carbon tax would be much better.
Mm-hmm.
But carbon tax, you know, nobody is talking about that at the national level. And then he turned around and he talked about what will happen, which is speeding up new oil and gas drilling permits. So I looked at that and I said, oh, that's really going to help global warming, you know, but that's part of his jobs package, speeding up oil and gas drilling. And of course, energy independence, that's the mantra. And it really is a Republican mantra that's now been co-opted by the Democrats. Yes, energy independence is a good thing regardless of how we get there, even if it makes global warming worse. And then he talked about infrastructure spending, the Fix It First program, you know, to fix roads, bridges, ports, and pipelines. And I'm thinking, wow, that's a great idea, you know, an idea I've had for many, many, many years now. And it's nice to hear a president say it. But then again, I had to ask myself, where's the money coming from? Because the Republicans will not spend the money for that. I waited for him to say how we were going to pay for it. And he mentions, well, let's attract private capital to this program. And so I said, okay, attract private capital means you're hoping that what, private companies will come in and throw money at this? I don't think so. So that's clearly not going to happen.
Unless they privatize and do like naming rights for highways.
Yeah, yeah. So and he talked about various things that are popular for the American people, like housing debt relief. But then again, his housing debt relief program, he's not proposing anything new or anything radical. It really would help a few people refinance. And at this point, that means people who have good credit and they have equity in their home, because to refinance, it really helps to have equity in your home and not be underwater on your mortgage. And there are people who are not behind on their payments. And really, if you look at it right now, refinancings are slowing down. And they're slowing down not because interest rates are rising. They're slowing down because everybody who could refinance has already done it, and they've done it multiple times in many cases. So encouraging more people to refinance is a dead end in terms of fixing the housing market. And he talked about education. That's one of the big things that the media has pulled out of his State of the Union address, is the spending expanding high-quality preschool. And I looked at that and I said, doing what? You know, expanding high quality. Okay. You know, and this is for me. I'm far left of liberal Democrat, and I never went to preschool. I didn't go to preschool. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a rural school district where public preschool wasn't available, but I just don't see the benefit. And I just don't see the need for spending that much money for preschool when there are so many other problems with the educational system. And of course, again, it'd be a nice thing to have if we had the money for it. And the money for it would be $3 to $20 billion, depending on who you talk about among education experts. And of course, he turned around and he said, well, I'd like it to be a federal program, but we're going to partner with the states to see if we can get it done, meaning that he's going to try to push states to find the money in their budgets. Looking at our state budget, we're $1 billion short on education, and that's not even talking about public preschool for all children. So that's not going to happen. And then he turned around and said, well, okay, the other education initiative I have is high schools partnering with colleges and employers to train kids in high-tech skills. And basically what that means is charter schools and privatization of schools. And you know that that's already happening. So that's a very clear case where he said, oh, this is what I would like, you know, that isn't going to happen. And this is what I'm also working on, which is happening, and it's not such a great thing. And then he mentioned immigration reform. But, of course, as soon as he started talking about immigration reform, the very first thing he said was a real reform means strong border security, which is right out of the Republican playbook. So number one on that list is making sure we have closed borders and providing immigration opportunities to people who have the money to pay for it and people whose job skills are highly coveted, like computer programmers and scientists and so forth.
People that Microsoft would like to.
Yeah. And then he talked about raising the minimum wage, which got a lot of coverage in the media. But, you know, as soon as you said $9 an hour, I laughed because that's still, you know, under the Washington state. That's lower than the Washington state minimum wage. And I got out my calculator and $9 an hour is $1,440 per month, which is still about 14% less than average rent in Seattle. And you might say, okay, well, not everybody in the nation lives in Seattle where it's expensive to live. But I would rebut that by saying, well, look, folks, most jobs are not in rural areas, okay? Most jobs are in big cities. And that's where the people are. This is a country that's going from that's becoming more and more urbanized, and a lot of the minimum wage jobs are in big cities where it's expensive to live. So the minimum wage has not only been keeping up with inflation, it's not even a realistic wage anymore in terms of what people need to make to live in the places where the jobs actually are. So, and you know, he includes some other things like tax credits for businesses to hire and invest and so forth. And in contrast, Marco Rubio's Republican rebuttal of Obama's State of the Union address was, I thought, really dismal. And it was very interesting because it was stuck it was like a one-note song stuck on endless repeat of less government, less government, less government, less government. And that's about all that was there of any kind of substance in the Republican rebuttal. And then overall I looked at it and I said, you know, this has been a pretty tough week for liberal Democratic leaders like Governor Inslee and President Obama, because they're trying to push this more jobs to get the economy going again on the level where most people live in the economy, not the corporate high flyers who are making tons of money right now. But there's a reason why they have to push business tax credits in order to get a jobs program going. It's because all of the spare cash in the economy is stuck at the level of these corporate high flyers. Corporations have like a record amount of cash on their books, about $1 trillion right now, that's just sitting there that they're not spending. And they're not hiring people for a reason. They're not using that cash to create jobs because right now consumer spending is really low, at a low point. People don't have the income. Average people don't have the income to go out and buy a lot of stuff, so corporations can't expand production and they're not hiring people. But that money is not being used for anything productive while it just sits there. So corporations are going, well, what can I do with that money? And they're not even considering as a first, second, or third option hiring more people. What they're considering is buying each other up. And we saw that this week with a lot of big mergers being announced where big corporations are using their cash and using the cash that banks are providing them in terms of low interest rate loans to go after their competitors and to consolidate. And usually when businesses do these big mergers and consolidate, it means more layoffs. It doesn't mean more jobs. So I thought that was kind of interesting to see that here you have Governor Inslee and President Obama literally on their knees begging major corporations, please use that cash to create jobs. Please use that cash to create jobs. And the only incentive they can really give, the only whip they can crack is tax exemptions, which are a dead end. Corporations don't need more cash. They've got plenty of cash. And when the government can't rouse itself to take some of that cash in the form of taxes and redistribute it or get a real jobs program going, then you have these Democratic leaders saying, oh, please use your cash to create jobs. We'll give you a tax break if you do it. So
you can come here and repair your jet.
Yeah. Exactly.
Give you a free cup of coffee.
Uh-huh.
Got just a little over a minute to touch on the foreign policy aspects of
You know, typically in years past, the foreign policy aspects of the State of the Union actually tended to dominate the State of the Union address, and it would all be about the wars in the Middle East, wars in the Middle East in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and how we have to stay the course and how we have to fight the terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. Obama spent about a third of his speech on foreign policy issues. And he talked about completing the military mission in Afghanistan. And if you're like me and you're wondering, really, what is the military mission in Afghanistan at this point? He spelled it out. He said, we're moving into a support role supporting the government of Afghanistan, which happens to be an extremely corrupt government that is being literally propped up with the billions of dollars that we're spending and that are going into the pockets of these Afghani leaders that are not doing the reconstruction that we've told them they should be doing. And Obama said, well, you know, the reason we're there is to go after al-Qaeda and its affiliate groups, by which I'm sure he meant the Taliban. But the Taliban is not an affiliate of al-Qaeda. And terrorism experts have basically said that. They're not the same. And that's really who we're fighting in Afghanistan. So I thought that was very interesting that he spent a lot of time talking about affiliate groups of al-Qaeda because, as everyone knows, al-Qaeda really no longer exists.
And, of course, the affiliates is part of his campaign for justification for use of drones without...
And the new cyber command, yeah.
All right. Any events?
Okay. Got a couple of events this week. Today, from 1 to 4 p.m. at Gasworks Park, is Idle No More, Protect the Sacred. It's a gathering to focus on protecting the environment from coal trains, mining, tar sands extraction, and pipeline construction. It's a movement led by Native Americans and their allies. So that's a good thing to show up for. And next Friday, on the 22nd, we'll be solving the budget puzzle, sharing our stories with our representatives from 7 to 8:30 at the Labor Temple at 2800 First Avenue. Folks can come and share short, powerful stories about the impacts of the economic crash on our communities. Seattle Senator Ed Murray is on the budget committee in Olympia, and we need to tell our representatives in Olympia what our budget priorities should be.
All right. Also happening today from 2 to 4 p.m., the No New Jim Crow Seattle campaign is putting on a panel discussion on racism, the war on drugs, and the role of law enforcement. That's 2 to 4 p.m. at Mount Zion Baptist Church at 19th and Madison here in Seattle. Talking as we do every week with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found online at www.eatthestate.org. And you can find more of my material at mariatomchik.com.